community events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Right Around Portland Book Release and Public Reading on Thursday, December 7th at 6:30 p.m. at the Beaverton Round Executive Suites in Beaverton. Know These is the 53rd collection of community writing. This reading will feature work written by participants in the fall 2017 writing workshops, including long-term HIV survivors, middle school students, young adults in a job training program, and many others. Again, that's Right Around Portland Book Release and Public Reading on Thursday, December 7th at 6:30 p.m. at the Beaverton Round Executive Suites, 12725 Southwest Milliken Way in Beaverton. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland for December 6th. And coming up this morning on KBOO for the remainder of the public affairs strip we got going here, it's the Politics of Living, Indigenous Peoples' Contributions to Science, Sex and Culture 101, The Politics of Food Choices, and the song Nasty Woman, recorded by 50 Portland musicians in response to last year's election. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11 o'clock, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. And don't forget that KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate, and you can become a member there. Thanks for doing that. And now we're going to get to the Politics of Living. Thanks for tuning into KBOO this morning.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kowalczyk. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, whether it's veganism, to living during these unsettling times, to reclaiming your personal power. Politics are everywhere. On today's show, Darka Dusty returns with her segment, 10 Minutes with Darka. Kristen Thiel introduces us to two champions of Indigenous Peoples' Contributions to Science. Liam Deltra brings us another Vox Pop from the streets of downtown Portland. And new contributor Lady Monte introduces us to a conversation about sexuality. But first, singer Ara Lee and songwriter Beth Wood went on a writing retreat earlier this year, fueled by the political situation that came out of last year's presidential election. They led the Creative Charge to produce a song to raise money for Planned Parenthood called Nasty Woman. Contributor Anessa Anderson recently spoke with the musicians about what infused their creative pursuit to produce such a powerful song.
On one side, I feel really hopeful, actually, that people are speaking out. But not only that, but it seems like people are listening for the first time about this. Mm-hmm. Especially men are listening about
men
this.
Men are. Mm-hmm. Men are, too, you think?
I feel hopeful about that. I don't know why it was that one particular person, Harvey Weinstein, that made this whole snowball kind of start to happen, because this has happened hundreds of times before with other men being accused, other powerful men. I don't know why he's the one, but what about the women who have accused our president? But on one hand, I'm really hopeful that this is coming out in the open, and men are opening their eyes and saying, oh my God, I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. Of what?
That
no
this
idea.
Happened. Like, for example, I wrote something about this. Mm-hmm. I was moved to write about this, and my dad said to me, oh my God, I had no idea that you've dealt with this in your life. I had no idea.
How old is your dad?
75. Mm-hmm. He said, I had no idea that happened to you. Over and over and over and over again.
So, Beth, for you, was it in the, what area did this happen to you in?
In the music industry, in trying to go to school, in college, in
any
other jobs I've had. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's rampant, but especially in the music business, it's something that, it's almost like expected.
You kind of just deal with it without thinking that this is just one of those things that happens.
And that's what gave me hope, because I had always been silent in the past because I figured this is just the way it is and things will never change. But maybe they will. I mean, I feel a little bit hopeful for that.
I think the phrase you used, being bone weary, that's exactly it. And I feel like that is how so many of us have felt since this election happened, particularly that turning point.
Yeah, last November.
I mean, bone weary before the election happened. We thought we were going to be through with it that day. And then, you know, came the long haul. And the whole Me Too movement, you know, it's a resurgence, right? I mean, it had kind of come up before, and now it's come back again with Harvey Weinstein and, you know, et cetera. And I think for me, you know, it's
you,
that,
Ara.
For me, Ara. It's that feeling of, God, I'm actually going to talk about this now. I have a story to tell. We all have stories to tell.
And your Nasty Woman video is so powerful, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I think for artists like you and Beth, it's a time to speak out.
That's right. So I remembered, I guess about 3 years ago, I started having memories of abuse that happened to me as a child that I had never remembered before.
You did not recall?
Did not
them.
Know. And there had been things in my life that had pointed to it, some things that I thought, this is a disproportionate response to what's happening right now. What's wrong with me? There must be something wrong with me.
Hmm.
And sexually, for many years, there have been things that have been very challenging. And a few years ago, I was actually having some body work done, and these memories started coming up. And then over time, they started coming more and more and more and more and more. And then a little bit later, I was having another session, and I remembered a name. I remembered a face. I remembered these things coming to the surface. And I still have yet to put all the pieces together exactly, but I have snippets now of memories that are coming up.
Yeah, and I've actually heard a lot of stories like that, as women are able to speak.
That's right.
I do have to say that the Me Too movement is good for people to finally say yes.
That's right. And in fact, Anessa, I've never talked about it before this moment with people that are not close friends. And the reason I'm talking about it now is because we're all talking about it.
That's
and I
right.
think so many women have these experiences and we just don't talk about it. It's so shameful. And that is the thing. Beth wrote this beautiful piece about shame and feeling like and guilt, even though guilt really shouldn't play in it, but shame, I think, is the word. And
isn't
then realizing
odd,
right,
that
like,
women feel
shame when it's not my shame to hold. And so Beth had written that piece that you wrote on Facebook. Was it last year? And you sent it to me. It was after Trump got elected.
Right.
And you had written.
I was waiting for the
right
moment.
And she said, "God, I wrote this thing in response because she was so fired up." And I read it, and I was like, "Oh God, Beth, I want this to go places," because she's an extraordinary writer and poet and wordsmith. And so she wrote this about her experience. And then when this happened, she posted it, and I was like, "Yes, this is it. This is the moment where we say, oh, that shame is not my shame to hold anymore. Shame on you, men, and shame on you people who have harmed our bodies in this way, and shame on our culture for making us feel shame." And so I think the beauty of all of this, in the middle of being bone weary, it's like seeing light. You know, I mean, I always feel like that analogy of when it's dark outside is when you see the stars. And when it's daytime, you know, you don't see them. It feels so dark right now. And every story and every woman that comes forward feels like a star in the sky saying, here is the truth. Here is the truth. Here is the truth.
And it will become light.
That's right. And the light is coming. And it feels like the tide is shifting. It really does.
Make yourself small.
I think this whole movement, the Me Too movement, I think also requires us as women to yet come to an awakening.
Yes.
Yes.
Because we can't just say, oh, it was him.
That's right.
You know, we as women, don't you all agree? We have to come to a reckoning of who we are and take our power back.
Absolutely.
You know, we cannot just say, oh, it's men.
That's right. Or he took my power, because we have also been trained to give it away, to hand it away. way,
yeah,
to the highest bidder. And mm-hmm. and so taking that back and saying, I will not give
right.
this away.
Well, it's not always, so it's, yeah. it's a taking back the power, but also claiming the power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly, Terry,
because
exactly.
we're not really raised to
finding it.
Power.
Finding. Yeah, finding it for ourselves. And I think that's very, very important mm-hmm. to not just say, men.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think that we have to claim our own power here.
Well, and I think that's what this song does beautifully, because mm-hmm. it's celebrating. Oh, yeah? You think I'm nasty because I'm strong and I speak my mind? Okay. I'm nasty. I am nasty.
Right. You say I hit like a girl?
Celebrating it.
Yes, I will.
So talk to me about how you fleshed it out. What were you thinking about?
All well, right. we wrote and wrote and wrote. We did drink some whiskey as well.
There might have been some whiskey.
This was in January. And, you know, and we...
You had to stay warm, right?
Oh, that's right. And I was looking through some of the old verses that we wrote that never made it in, but did I make the mistake of being too, you know, fat? Did I make the mistake of being too... I mean, did I make the mistake of... And every woman we talk to has their own list. I made the mistake of being too short. I made the mistake of being too bossy.
How tall are you?
Oh, I'm 5'9". I didn't make that mistake. No. I made the mistake of being too tall. Mine's the opposite. I made the mistake of being too large, you know.
Yeah.
But also, did I make the mistake of shaking my behind? That's the mm-hmm. one Beth loved that we had to mm-hmm. cut. Did I make the mistake of speaking my mind? Did I make the mistake mm-hmm. of shaking my behind? Did I make the mistake not falling in line behind you?
So you can see how fun that was. Once we started that ball rolling, we couldn't stop. I mean, we could not stop.
I wonder how we should go forward. We can't just look at the latest headline and go, ugh. You know, we have to kind of take each day. I liked looking at your video to reboot my mm-hmm. heart, you know, and say it's going to be okay.
This understanding of being competitive, or you know, what you do or what I do is better or worse, and you know, that's sort of that law of when you don't have power, you kind of fight each other for it. And I think in this time, using our words positively and highlighting what people do, what men and women do,
that's right.
that are
what
extraordinary.
Men do that are,
oh, and Peter mm-hmm. Mulvey. Can you talk about Peter Mulvey?
I don't even know how to talk about
and
Peter
his posts, because the posts from men responding to this video mm-hmm. just
the response from men has been overwhelming to me, and I've had men friends in my life reach out personally, mm-hmm. Three or four different ones. And it's, and they're saying, we're listening. We're listening.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really hopeful time. So I think what we can do is support each other in that mm-hmm. and say, thank you. Keep listening.
Yeah. And keep the tone positive.
Mm-hmm.
We have a long way to go. And when you watch something that's that powerful, because you see the positivity and the joy and the commitment, these are things that will move us forward. Saying, oh, man, blah, 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 blah. Oh, these people. This doesn't move anyone forward. This moves no one forward. But moving each other forward by seeing each other. I mean, you sat down and start talking to Beth, and I was like, oh my God, Anessa has the most beautiful voice I have ever heard.
I know.
You know, but sometimes for women, we don't say that, you know, to each other, or wow, you're so beautiful, or wow, look at what you've done. And my hope is that as the tide turns, we look at each other and with no spirit of competition and say, it is our time, and what light do you have, and how can I shine it on you?
Hold each other up.
Yeah. Shining each other's light
yeah. mm-hmm.
on all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both, Ara and Beth.
Thank you so
much. Thank you, Anessa.
And now let's listen to that track, Nasty Woman.
One of the most refreshing byproducts of the search to secure rights for women is the emphasis on freeing both sexes from restrictive stereotypes.
The goal for all of us should be that one day things will be done neither because of nor in spite of any of the differences between us.
What we gotta do is keep working to break down discrimination, to break down the glass ceiling.
Women that I have seen in organizations have not been able to have the opportunity they deserve to have in getting ahead in organizations. If we're gonna compete as a nation, we've gotta draw upon the skills of women.
There's no greater focus than liberating women from the clutches of tyranny and the clutches of disease.
Millions and millions of women, cervical cancer, breast cancer, are helped by Planned Parenthood. So you can say whatever you want, but I would defund it because I'm pro-life. But millions of women are helped by Planned Parenthood. I will take care of women. I respect women.
My Social Security payroll contribution will go up, as will Donald's, assuming he can't figure out how to get out of it. But what we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund by making sure that we have sufficient resources.
Women are leading America at every level of society, from Hollywood to Silicon Valley, and that is progress. We also have to remember that progress is not inevitable. It's the result of decades of slow, tireless, often frustrating, and unheralded work.
Is it a shoe?
My mama told me what it was to be a woman. She said, girl, you had a choice. They might take your body, try to take your mind. They cannot take your voice. She said, these boots were made for walking now. But I wore my high heel shoes. And I did it uphill in the snow of conference rooms. Now I got the nasty woman blues. Did I make nasty woman, yeah, I'm a nasty woman. Ooh, I'm a nasty woman, nasty woman, yeah, I'm a nasty woman. You say my ass was made for you to grab it, but I shouldn't put up a fight. You say I hit like a girl, I say believe it, 'cause you just might be right. Well, I'm your mother, I'm your sister, I'm your daughter, and I say it's time for a change. 'Cause it ain't freedom to roll at the table. It ain't freedom to roll in again. Did I make the mistake of speaking my rage? Did I make the mistake of looking my age? Did I make the mistake of ending my wage equally? Must be a nasty woman. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Must be a nasty woman. Ooh, I'm a nasty woman. Nasty woman, yeah. I'm a nasty woman. You try to clip my wings, but they're growing now. Oh, don't you know a bird was made to fly? Did I make the mistake of taking the crown from your head? Well, did I make the mistake of shining too bright? Did I make the mistake of a fight? Did I make the mistake of defending my right to choose? Oh, oh, must be a nasty woman.
Next up, the She-Ra Solution is a monthly biography of women past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. Its title is inspired by Marie Theresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published in The Atlantic. On today's segment, Kristen introduces us to two women who are champions of Indigenous people's contributions to science.
You
Humans have been developing and making use of scientific principles for as long as we have existed. But along the way, as always happens, a select group took control of the written record, and Western science has all but obliterated the incredible efforts of others. Fortunately, a new select group is working to not only save those contributions from obscurity, but incorporate them into modern practice. Carly Noon is one scientist working toward this goal. She graduated from the University of Newcastle in Australia with a joint degree in math and physics and is now an astronomer. Around the time of her university studies, she learned more about the astronomical contributions of the first inhabitants of what we now know as Australia, New Zealand, and the Torres Strait. These contributions were made many, many years before the Western discoveries that are written about in textbooks. For example, these people long ago knew that the tides varied depending on the phases of the moon. They predicted the weather by watching the night skies. A moon halo, for example, the bright rings sometimes visible around the moon, meant ice crystals were in the air. The number of stars between the moon and the halo could indicate how much rain would soon fall. The fewer the stars, the more likelihood of heavier rain. Noon says Western science agrees. More water vapor in the air, rain, would mean visibility would be obstructed, which would mean fewer stars to count. Her mission to highlight Aboriginal knowledge is not necessarily to change accepted fact. The older knowledge supports the newer, in fact. What she is trying to do is give credit where credit is due, and create a more comprehensive and truthful history of science. She's also trying to positively affect the future. According to a recent BBC article about her, her main passion is getting Indigenous women involved in the sciences. University enrollment of people from Indigenous groups is not representative of their numbers within the general population. If Indigenous scientific knowledge was part of the official mainstream historical record, more people may feel included today and may wish to become scientists in the future. This could be particularly beneficial to girls. More so than in Western tradition, in these societies, in the past at least, women were recognized for their role in science. They were knowledge keepers. If girls today could be reminded of how their ancestors included women in science, they may feel more comfortable claiming their space. Of course, some modern scientists are bringing traditional knowledge to the fore because it can add to the current scientific conversation. Halfway around the world from where Carly Noon is working in Australia and New Zealand, Hindu Umaru Ibrahim is incorporating her people's traditional knowledge to monitor and correct environmental changes in the African country of Chad. Lake Chad, a crucial resource for people and livestock in Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria, is 10% the size it was in the 1960s. To understand why, and to get the community involved in solving this issue, Ibrahim launched a 3D mapping project that combines modern technology with traditional scientific knowledge about local landscape, water resources, and plant life. Science developed by the indigenous peoples of Chad is vital to this project. It also turns a modern scientist, Ibrahim, into inspiration for future generations. Speaking about herself to the BBC, Ibrahim said, quote, "When they hear what a little indigenous girl coming from the communities has done, maybe it can give them more courage to fight for women's rights." When I read this article about scientists actively elevating science done by indigenous peoples to its rightful position beside that of Westerners, I immediately connected their stories to one of my longtime favorite authors. Nello Hopkinson is a Caribbean-Canadian author of science fiction and speculative fiction. She will be the first to say she's no scientist. She didn't even do particularly well in those classes in school, but she is pleased that her imagined ideas for her novels have an impressive track record with her scientist friends. They say that real science supports her ideas. I see Hopkinson as also approaching the issue of who knows and who owns scientific discovery, just from a different angle. When she was writing Brown Girl in the Ring, which won publisher Warren Aspect's Best First Novel contest, she was reading a lot of science fiction, of course, and what she realized was that so much of it drew on Western culture. Hopkinson, who grew up in Jamaica, Trinidad, and Guyana before her family settled in Toronto, Canada, told Caribbean Beat magazine, quote, "I felt that Caribbean culture and folklore offered an equally robust source from which to draw." She always uses slang, grammar, and linguistic cadence from Caribbean cultures. Her futuristic or fantastical societies are based in Caribbean history and myth. For example, her third novel, The Salt Roads, includes details about Haitian deities and Jamaican dance halls. This inclusion of reality provides clues to her imagined legends, and vice versa. That balance between the two is important to Hopkinson. She would never write reality, she has said. Quote, I prefer fantasy and science fiction. They're genres that actively say that change is possible. We've done wrong by eliminating, ignoring, not including all the knowledge and efforts that have brought us to where we are today. But no text is written in stone. Thanks to people like Carly Noon and Hindu Umaru Ibrahim in the sciences and Nalo Hopkinson in the scientific fictions, we are remembering our greater truths and making stronger futures. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was Kristen Thiel with this month's The She-Ra Solution. To learn more about the women featured, check out the links on our show page by visiting kboo.fm, search for The Politics of Living, and look for Episode 10. We have a new contributor this month. Lady Monte is the host and producer of Permutations, a segment that will look at using an alternative lens on sex and sexuality from a person with a mutated sex chromosomes. On today's segment, she interviewed Olivia Jarrett, a sex educator from Planned Parenthood, to talk about the topic that surrounds us as a society, sex. We'll learn that sexuality is more than anatomy, more than an act. It's part of the human experience from birth to death.
Hello, everybody. My name is Lady Monte. Welcome to the first installment of Permutations, perspectives on sex culture from the viewpoint of somebody with a mutated sex chromosome, otherwise known as intersex. This show will focus on our society and how we engage with sex. What is sex and what is sexy? How much is in the eye of the beholder and based on cultural inflections, and how much comes from a drive to fulfill a biological need for sex? Let's address this, because the more we know ourselves, the more we own ourselves. And the way I see it, sexuality has been dictated and owned by others for far too long. This first episode, I interview Olivia Jarrett, a sex educator from Planned Parenthood, to try to determine what understandings about ourselves create the foundations of sex as a culture. What can we understand more clearly about our sexual selves that will facilitate consent, health, and ultimate pleasure? I learned that sexuality is more than anatomy. Sex is more than an act. It is part of the human experience from birth until death.
So my name is Olivia Jarrett. I'm a community education and outreach coordinator for Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette here in Portland. I do a lot of things. I, of course, teach sex ed, which is really for any ages and any settings. We're really expanding. So much of sex ed we think of in high schools, that has not always worked. I teach at residential treatment facilities. I've been trying to do some at housing complexes. We do parent ed. Some of my colleagues have done puberty education for sixth graders around that age. Working in drop-in centers.
And now you do radio interviews.
That's right.
You educate on air.
That's right.
Bringing it to you.
Every place I go into is a little different and needs different things. One thing that I make sure to talk about is how people define sex. So I usually say, can someone tell me what sex is? And then they all get really uncomfortable. But really, a lot of times what happens is they say sex is vaginal sex or normal sex.
Okay. So just a question, you see more people defining sex as an action and not as a body part?
A little bit of both ways.
Okay.
But more often, yeah. And what I'm really getting at is, when I'm teaching sex ed, the initial thing is I need them to define sex, and I need them to know that sex in action is a big conversation.
Right.
If they define it as penis and vagina sex, it's a great opportunity to say that leaves a lot of people out, and let's think about that. Let's broaden our definition of sex in terms of the verb and things that people do together. And that kind of sets the conversation up for just a bigger knowledge base.
Right.
So there are eight different pieces. So sensuality and pleasure, sexual activity, reproductive health and anatomy,
okay.
gender, relationships, love and affection, body image, and sexual orientation.
How do you talk about sex mm-hmm. parts?
Right. So one thing we do in terms of just wanting to be as inclusive as we can all the time, we talk about body parts. So we right. say someone with a vagina, someone with a penis, someone with a uterus.
Okay.
Instead of putting a gender on that.
Okay.
And some, it's funny, some people know exactly why we're doing that, and other people are kind of like, they giggle every time I say someone with a penis.
Okay.
But really, we want to focus on body parts, not necessarily gender, and kind of be able to separate those two in how we're teaching, like model that.
At what part do genitals come into play mm-hmm. and genital talk and body parts? And when, like, I guess one of the things that people think of is like, okay, when does it turn into sex? Like, from hanging out and mm-hmm. maybe even just kissing and then moving on to like actual sex, especially when you're talking about the concept of sex as an experience, and you can be in a very sexual moment. But at what parts do you think that hygiene and caution and a greater sense of awareness comes into play?
So what we normally say is there are three main types of sex we talk about when we talk about risk.
Okay.
So it's vaginal, anal, and oral.
Okay.
And genital to genital touching. And also say, well, if there are hand jobs happening, right, if someone's touching someone else's genitals and then touches their own, there is a fluid exchange.
Okay.
So we talk about, there could be a fluid exchange. So we talk about six fluids. Do you know the six fluids?
No, I don't know. This is so fascinating.
Semen, pre-ejaculatory fluid.
Okay.
Vaginal fluid.
Should I write this down?
You don't have to write it down. Blood. Breast milk, which is for HIV, and anal mucus. So it's like the saliva of our anus, basically. Saliva's in our mouth.
That's so sexual.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then skin to skin of like mouth and genitals. Those are the things that transmit STIs. I mean, it's really opening up like, what is sex? What are we here to talk about?
Okay.
And breaking the ice a little bit.
Okay. So what about, what if I raised my hand and I said, okay, sex for me is what makes a baby. What would you say?
So I say people define sex in all different ways.
Okay.
And everybody gets to have their own definition of sex, but we want to make sure everybody gets to have their own definition of sex. And we need to be mindful of that. And one thing I say a lot is that when people think sex is penis and vagina sex, they're leaving out all the other types of sex. People can define it however they want, but my concern is that there's risk involved in other types of sex. Also talking about virginity as a tool, something that's used against people mm-hmm. or taken away from people, or even just popping the cherry is a very violent sounding term.
And oh my
it
gosh.
Leaves out too. Yeah. So I try to just say, like, think about that term.
Okay.
Think about why people talk about virginity, how it's used against people,
okay.
who it's okay to be a virgin, not okay to be a virgin, and what does virginity even mean? Because as soon as you go beneath the surface, you realize it doesn't really mean anything.
Right.
Socially constructed completely.
Right. Socially constructed value based on mm-hmm. ownership of people's bodies.
Exactly.
Interesting. So we're talking about sex, and we're putting it in this very safe and appropriate and welcoming context of it is something that you agree to do with consent, with somebody mm-hmm. that you trust and are comfortable with. And you also talk about health and hygiene. How do you deliver these messages? And how do you talk about, you know, actual application of these information? What you're talking about is addressing a culture which purposefully hijacks people's idea of self through virginity and sexuality and stuff like that. And you're providing them an alternative reality to think about themselves and their bodies and their reactions and their interactions with people. This can be a lot to digest in a couple hours. What teaching methods do you use, and what kind of languages do you use?
Yeah, so when we talk about language, there are a few different things, tools we use. So I have this sexuality wheel or pie that was created.
Yeah.
So the middle says sexuality is more than sex. It is a physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual journey from birth to death. This birth to death piece is really important for us. You know, babies touch their genitals. Penises can get erections when on tiny babies because it is simply a function of the body. The way we reproduce in general, I mean, a sperm and an egg have to meet in order for humans to still exist, right?
Right.
And one of the ways, one of the most common ways is through sex. So we are sexual beings. If we weren't, then we would cease to exist.
Right.
Right? Granted, people are all over on the spectrum, right? Some people, so asexuality, people might not experience sexual desire and attraction, which is totally normal. And obviously different intersex conditions, right? So there are things around that, but at the core, we have to remember that humans are sexual beings. Most of us have certain things that make up us being sexual beings, and we can't ignore that or think that it only starts when you go through puberty.
Okay.
And it might not be sexualized, like when my 2-year-old touches her vulva,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
She's not having sexual thoughts. Right. She's like, oh, this feels kind of cool, and it's on my body. Let me check it out, right?
And it's mine.
Right.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's really important to know that. And STI rates in the senior crowd, older folks, are high.
Okay.
So anyway, birth to death is really important. In utero, we all start with the same genitalia, and then based on chromosomes and the hormones that are introduced, it changes, the genitals grow in different ways. You know, here is what a typical assigned male looks like, typical assigned female, and there can be variations anywhere in between. You know, it's a spectrum. Here are the two things that we oftentimes see, and really equating the penis and the clitoris instead of penis and vagina. Those are not equivalent. They are body parts. I actually draw the vulva on the board really as a function of showing how a dental dam works on a vulva and an anus.
Okay.
The bonus is that I get to talk about the clitoris that is left out in a lot of teaching materials.
And left out of a lot of other things. Don't forget about the clitoris.
That's right. And I don't know if you know this, I just did a bunch of research. Only until 1995 did they understand the full structure of the clitoris.
Oh, it's so much larger than the
75% of it is under the surface.
Yes.
I also feel like there's this piece of, if people understand pleasure, consent naturally follows. If pleasure is the focus, my personal feeling is that if pleasure is the focus of sex, consent will naturally follow. If people are concerned about their partner receiving pleasure, consent is there.
That's a great way to teach the class. Pleasure leads to consent. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So focus on that. Regardless of what people's roles are defined by, you know what I mean? And what they're defined as, like through their genitals or through their assigned genders or whatever. Focus on pleasure.
Right. And also, to be clear, like I said, I teach all ages, right?
Yeah.
So when I'm teaching adults, that conversation is probably going to look a lot different than when I'm teaching young people. We're not going to be talking much about that. It's all very age appropriate, right? So giving them only as much as they're kind of ready to wrap their head around, and starting talking about these principles of, like, you get to decide what happens with your body.
So what's the flip side of that? And we talked a little bit earlier about how people's virginities and their concept of their own sexual identity and their own sexuality, in some way or another, they're born into it being owned by this perception, this external perception, and creates a lot of, like, erroneous thoughts and conceptions about consent and pleasure and what sex is for and what your own anatomy is for, whatever stage of development and what your genitals look like and whatever you call them as well. Like, it creates a lot of thoughts about what people's anatomies are used for. And I asked that question earlier, if I was a kid and I raised my hand and said sex is to make babies, you know, and that's true, because, you know, like you said, the sexuality aspect of our culture is so that we can survive as a culture. So I think there's a lot of importance placed on reproductive roles. But obviously there's people with sexuality involved in their lives that are outside of reproductive roles as far as having babies. Intersex people being one of them, or maybe asexual people, or even heteronormative cisgender people might not want to have kids, but they still want to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally fair. So now we're talking about the pleasure principle and how anatomy can create pleasure through sex, and also leads to consent culture, which is a beautiful thing. How would you talk about it from that angle, like talking about people's anatomy and, you know, going back to what you said earlier about people's sexuality being owned? Like, what's your comment on that?
Yeah, so there are a lot of values that come up, right? And like you said, we're factual. We bring facts.
Right.
And we want to move people into a space where the questions are at least being asked for them to think about bigger values in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And even if their values don't shift, at least think about it, right? And it's not my role to say what their values should be, but I want to open these ideas up. Because the first time people understand that there's a difference between gender and sex, it's like mind blown, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of big concepts, and I know I can only do a little bit, but I do like asking the questions and also saying, like, how would someone figure out what they like to do, what they like or what their partner likes? And ask them.
Okay.
And they're like, talk about it. And I'm like, is that hard to talk about? And sometimes they're like, yeah, it's really hard to talk about. I was like, it might be awkward. So just do it. And I mean, we see full-grown adults, they've been in a partnership forever and they have no idea how to talk about sex. And so we want people starting to talk about sex, communicating with their partner what they want. We talk about when consent should happen. Should it happen before sex is being had, or like when you're in the moment, or after, or during? And the answer is all of it.
Yeah.
Right? And really picking up on cues for the person that we're complete humans and there are a lot of different aspects. So body image is a piece of our sexuality, right?
Yeah.
Love and affection
All right, cool. And that's, I mean, that's actually a pretty comprehensive class.
One thing we've been really trying to focus on is access.
Access
to healthcare.
Okay.
So we know that we can go teach about birth control and barrier methods and getting tested, but if people don't know how to access that care,
right,
then what are we really doing? So focusing on sometimes just listing all the sexual healthcare services,
right,
and how someone might access that. A lot of young people have questions on legally what's their right and what can they access, especially if they feel unsafe letting their parents know. Of course, we know parents are the best sex educators. We want young people to be talking to their parents about everything.
Right.
But sometimes that isn't safe for them.
Right.
So, and the laws are written so that young people can access care without age restrictions, which is different in each state. But we want to make sure people understand the ins and outs of that.
Well, that's great. I'm very excited to know that Planned Parenthood is still out there alive and kicking and teaching us about all the things we need. So sexuality, health, consent, pleasure, and access. Access is the most important thing, especially for a healthy community. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks.
This has been Olivia Jarrett from Planned Parenthood. Thank you for listening. This has been Lady Monte. As an intersex person born outside of typical sexual reproductive roles due to my genetics and body development, that changed how my sexual identity was perceived within and by our culture. My experience is my own, but how do you feel your own sexual expression has been perceived by society? How much of your identity is due to which body parts you were born with and the roles that came with them? How much do you listen to your body when it comes to sex, and how often are you listening to something else? Remember, we are all just permutations of the same human algorithm, so if you regard your sexual reflections with love, respect, and awareness, you might just unlock the key to your own delight as well.
Contributor Darka Dusty returns with her segment for The Politics of Living called 10 Minutes with Darka. She chats with Susan Hashem about the politics of our food choices, with a focus on transitioning to veganism, to saving the world one bite at a time.
Hi, this is Darka Dusty, and this is my second installment of 10 Minutes with Darka. So my guest today is Susan Hashem, who is a small business owner here in Portland, and she's also a vegan. And I wanted to talk about the politics of what we eat a little bit with Susan. Hi, Susan.
Hello.
So, well, I wanted to let you know, and you probably do, that I am a vegetarian, but I'm in the middle of my own transition to veganism. I have decided that I need to be really conscious about what I eat and the effect that my decisions have on the world around me. So tell me, very straightforward question, how did you become a vegan?
When I was about 7 years old, we lived across the street from a cow pasture. It was a dairy farm. And I would go across the street and I would pet all the baby cows. And I loved them. They were super cute. I named one Joey. He would come when I called him. And one day I went out and I called for them and they were all gone.
Wow.
So I went inside and I told my mother that the cows were gone, and where did she think they went? And she said, oh, they're probably going to be hamburger now. So that was my first sort of experience with, like, oh, wow, this is where my food is coming from. And so I didn't really eat hamburgers for years, and I've always been very, like, I don't really eat a lot of meat. But then when I was in my 20s, I finally was pregnant with my daughter, and I decided that I didn't want to bring any of, like, milk hormones into my body or any of the stuff that was in meat. So I went vegan for 3 years when I had her, and she was vegan for the first 2 years of her life. But because I live with a meat eater, I kind of slid back into eating meat off and on for pretty much the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And finally, I would say 2 years ago, I really started getting involved with online vegan communities, and there's a lot of activists and activist groups that I follow, and started watching a lot of slaughterhouse videos. Yeah. I started watching movies like Cowspiracy and What the Health, and all of these things talking about, like, the damage that we do to our bodies, the damage we do to the environment, and mostly for me, the ethical reasons why you don't want to kill sentient beings because they have feelings and they are tortured and they suffer greatly.
Yeah.
So I would say the last year and a half I've really stopped all of it. And I'm very passionate about it now because it just really clicked and I had a light bulb moment like, okay, this is it. You cannot continue to eat or participate in this agriculture environment. So,
well, that's really inspiring because for years I have been a vegetarian. I have not eaten meat since 1994, but I have continued to eat dairy under the misconception that somehow dairy is less detrimental to these animals, where I just actually found out that it's the opposite. Meat cows get to graze all day and just make sure that they have good meat at the end of the product line, whereas dairy animals suffer over and over and over again. Cows, am I right about this? Cows,
yes. Yeah. They are inseminated about 10 months old, and they are inseminated every year until about 4 or 5 years when they can no longer produce enough milk anymore, and they basically cannot stand up anymore.
Yeah.
And then those dairy cows that have been used for 4 years get sent to slaughter, and they are used for cheap hamburger meat.
Cheap hamburger meat. Okay, yeah. So the hamburger meat that you eat that is like the ground chuck or whatever,
That would be dairy cows that have been spent by the dairy industry.
And what happens to the little male cows that get born?
There's actually no reason for them to exist in the dairy industry. They are not going to grow into steer because they're a different breed of cattle. They are either killed immediately after birth, or they are put into veal crates, and they are sold at about, you know, anywhere from 6 months to, 6 weeks to 6 months, and then they are sent off to slaughter, and they also are going to be hamburger meat,
right?
And they are also going to soft leather goods.
Well, you know what's interesting about this is the thing with going vegetarian versus vegan, going vegan versus vegetarian, it's a big transition for me. What can I do to help that transition, and what can other people do right now? People who are thinking about their choices and, of course, the impact that the big agri farms have on the environment. What was that statistics we talked about a moment ago?
51% of greenhouse gases are attributed to animal agriculture.
Did you hear that, everybody? 51%.
More than all transportation in the world.
Right. So if you're an environmentalist, instead of just riding your bike, if you want to make a super impact, cut down or eliminate all meat. But what I was getting at is, what can we do to help ourselves with the transition? You were mentioning to me earlier before we started that there's a vegan kit. Tell me about that.
There's a 22-day challenge. It's and it's called challenge22.com, and you can go online, and they will help you transition to veganism. They have actual mentors for you. They have recipes. They're a really good resource for movies to watch that will inspire you more, because I feel like watching films and getting involved in some of the looking at vegan activism, some of their videos really will help kind of get you more set in your, like, yes, I really need to do this for the planet, for my health, for the animals. So that's a really good resource right there.
And those movies, tell me one more time what they were so we could write them down.
The biggest one I would say is Cowspiracy, which has been really, really important, I think, for the vegan movement right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Netflix. They also have a second movie now called What the Health, which is looking more at dietary issues, the health of our people in our country, how it's all kind of tied up with big pharma, and you know how you need to get off of this milk and get off of this dairy to renew your health and to not depend on pills and your doctor and surgeries. So
Remember in the 70s that whole campaign about dairy being like part of the food pyramid? That's so not true.
No, it's not true. And I find it really interesting because I've had two children, breastfed both of them, and people were like, when are you going to wean her? you better wean them quickly. I mean, they're just going to be nursing forever. And then it's like, well, you want me to wean them from my breast milk to get them onto the breast milk of a cow, which doesn't make any sense to me, because we've all been weaned, even if we were never breastfed. We've all been weaned off of whatever we're supposed to have. And then we're all still drinking the breast milk of another species, which is crazy.
Yeah.
No other species does that.
No other species. No. I know. And think how sad it is. Those little cows never get to taste it. They're born and they never get to taste it. They just get whisked off and then they're all crying. And so it's just sad and misery. Yep. And
they feed them a formula that is so lacking in nutrients, because veal, they don't want it to be red. So it's very low in iron, and these cows get calves are weak. They can barely stand.
Sad. We want to end off on a positive note, because this is the holiday season, and so we don't want to scare all these people off who might be considering a change to veganism. But I want to ask you, with the couple of minutes that we have left to save the world in 10 minutes, I wanted to ask you, what has been your most delicious vegan food discovery since turning vegan? Tell me something we can make or something we can get somewhere here in Portland that is just irresistible.
Well, pretty much anything that you can eat as a meat eater and a dairy consumer, you can have as a vegan. There's so many new restaurants that are popping up that are all vegan.
Yeah.
But as far as my own cooking, I really like to use not chicken broth, not beef bouillons, because that makes all of your soups and everything taste amazing.
Yeah.
You will never know the difference. And also there's a website called Bosch, B-O-S-H, which has amazing recipes on there. They're simple, they're easy to follow. They show you, like, in 2 minutes how to make a beautiful vegan supper.
Right.
And they do a lot of, like, cashew cheeses. Nut cheeses are really amazing. There's a book out called This Cheese is Nuts, which is amazing. You can learn how to make fettuccine and soft ripened cheeses and cheddars in this one book, and it's really awesome.
And those fettuccines, they taste just as naughty as a cheesy one, right?
They do, but then you don't have a big gut bomb feeling.
Right.
You don't feel heavy afterwards. It's really amazing.
Yeah, and you didn't, eat anything that someone suffered to give you.
No.
Like milk.
Yeah,
this is me right now, and I asked you right here to interview you today because I am in that transition. So if anybody wants to talk about that with me, please contact me through the KBOO link that we're going to have on the website. And good luck, everybody, if you're making these choices for yourself. It's important to think about what you put in your mouth, where you put your money, and the politics of all of this. And, of course, just being a better human means treating other sentient beings with respect and love. So thanks a lot, Susan.
Thanks
and
for having me.
Yeah, happy holidays, everyone.
You too, yeah.
Take care.
And now here's part two of a Vox Pop by our very own Liam Delta. He recently went to downtown Portland to ask folks what they've been doing to keep sane in this wild world that we live in.
You revel in it. Let it unfold. You don't take it personally, and you just watch it. That's it.
Well, keep an open mind. Everyone's different. You just don't really know what someone's going through. Besides that, you just kind of listen to music and focus on your own thing.
I'd usually just go to work and go home. I had to come see my doctor, so that's why I'm downtown. Just try to stay away from it.
Music, baby.
I write poetry, and one of the awesome people, my good friends around here, and these awesome people keep me safe and make sure that I'm not harmed. And then I just pray to my higher power, whether it's my mom or Jesus Christ, because every person that tells me no, there's always four more that says yes, because they have a good heart.
It's like me, I turn to my music and my Lord and my son.
Music helps me cope, and marijuana. Yeah.
Being outside is kind of a pain, but I'm from Alaska, so it doesn't really harm me too much. I do have a lot of supporters that are trying to get me in places.
You need to turn to Jesus, he'll take care of you. Has done that for me many years since I became a Christian in 1974.
Photography, keep me busy, keep me preoccupied.
Yeah, I don't really watch the news because every time you watch the news, there's always negativity. The media always put everything out of proportion. And also, I work as well, and I spend time with my family.
I ignore it. I distance myself. I focus on my kids, and I get them away from the weirdos that are downtown.
Go to work and do my job. That's the main thing that I do.
I'm kind of used to it now.
I work in the woods, in the forest. I stay away from all the craziness.
It's just a matter of keeping your inner balance, I think, no matter what's going on. It does have some effects, but you can't solve every problem in the world, and you can't take care of things that you can't take care of.
I have a lot of tolerance and patience, and I mean, there are different kinds of people all over, so really it's just your perspective and your compassion for people. I don't turn on the news anymore. It upsets me all the time. I do a lot of volunteer work with the elderly and give them Meals on Wheels and dedicate my time to children. I guess just making it personal and staying away from the politics side, it's really frustrating. So I guess I stay a little bit away.
I try to do good work and hold on to hope.
Just ignore it. Just keep walking, ignore it. Mind my own business.
I just avoid it.
There's so much weirdness going on, racism. It's gotten so bad that I've kept a racist log of people that have been racist toward me, and I hardly ever want to even leave my house. It's just too crazy out there.
I just, when I get to the edge where I'm about to snap, I just take myself out of that situation, go let it out somewhere else to like a tree, or just, you know, go yell by myself.
I just shut it out. I'm sitting right in the probably the epicenter of lunacy, right here. They talk to me, I just look at them like, I don't speak your language.
Part of it is I don't live in Portland. The greater world, I believe, is in the hands of the Lord Jesus Christ, and he's big enough to handle it, and I don't have to worry about it, because I trust him.
My work. I work for DePaul Treatment Centers.
Embrace it. Just embrace it. Just people watch, smile, be friendly, say hi to people.
I try to stay focused on my little circle and the things that I'm doing in the world.
Stop and relax and be yourself. That's all I do.
Well, I'm weird, so I don't know what normal is.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Anessen Anderson, Darka Dusty, Lady Monte, and Liam Delta. Thanks to our guests as well. And thanks to our technical editor, Liam Delta, and our webpage manager, Vicky Mazzone. We're going to close out with a new track by local musician Marissa Anderson. Marissa is a former artist in resident here at KBOO. And this track that we'll be listening to is from her newly released album, Traditional and Public Domain Songs. It's off the Mississippi Records label. So here's Amazing Grace. Thanks so much for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Denise Kowalczyk. Have a great day. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage in Portland. The community rights movements help cities and towns to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their people and natural areas. At the Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In event, the leaders of Community Rights US will speak, as well as Mark Lakem. Again, that's Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage, 416 Southeast Oak Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, we've got Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And stay tuned at 11 for the bike show today, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and elsewhere. And we'll get to that at 11 o'clock. For now, here comes Air Cascadia.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, December 6, 2017, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio, your sanctuary radio, your resistance radio, your whistleblower radio, and your fake news radio. We're absolutely all over fake news here at KBOO. The Hey Duke Lives station. And of course, we want to take a moment to thank all of you who participated in our recent membership drive. Those who became new members, welcome, welcome, welcome. Those who are renewing members, always, always welcome. Those who listened or volunteered in any way, shape, or